All right, well, it's another Channel 9 interview, and we are with Chris Wilson, who is an architect on the PM team. You've met him before, and today we're going to talk about IE8 Beta 1.
Right on, yeah.
All right, so we talked about ACID 2 last mm-hmm. time we had you and Dean.
Yep.
But we didn't really get into APIs and other new things. So tell us a little bit about what's in Beta 1. What's
sure.
The key?
So, you know, the first thing to keep in mind is, Charles, is that Beta 1 is really a developer release. It's not intended to be, you know, here's our new user interface, here's all the user features we're going to ship, anything like that. It really is the first release of the developer platform and all the work that we've put into the developer platform in IE8. You know, looking at the work that we've done around developers and what the platform has and how that affects users as well, you know, making sure the browser works as the user thinks it will and as the developer thinks it will. I mean, we spent a tremendous amount of time working out a lot of standards bugs, making sure that every last little detail of what we've done so far follows the standard, follows interops with other browsers as well, you know, works the same way as other browsers. Or if it doesn't, we figure out why the standard and the browser implementation aren't the same and we try to get that fixed. The second thing is really just general productivity for developers in particular. You know, in IE7, we had this great developer tool that we sort of kind of started over with, frankly. We had one a long, long time ago, and it had stopped working, so we started over with a new one. But with IE8, we took that several steps further. We integrated debugging into that directly, made sure that debugging actually works really well.
Nice.
That's been sort of a point of contention with developers before with IE. Is debugging was pretty hard. Debugging JavaScript is pretty hard. Mm. And then kind of inspecting and interacting with the code on your page was sort of challenging, so we've done a bunch of great tools to do that. And finally, actually editing your page with the developer tools. Mm. And then we also took the developer tools and just put them right in the product. So you don't have to go find some other install. You don't have to go figure out what the magic reg key to turn on debugging in the JScript engine is or anything like that. It's all right there. It's ready to go. You know, my mom doesn't really need to ever see it, of course, but it's certainly there for any developer who just wants to casually inspect something, see what's going on, flip into a different compatibility mode or something. And then the third thing was really around power, just power for the user in terms of, you know, performance and security and that sort of thing, giving them the confidence that they're really using, you know, that they're seeing the best of the web. Mm. But for developers as well, not only did we add a bunch of standard support, because we really are targeting the whole CSS2 specification with this release, you know, doing a lot of work around layout and style sheets. And we're not done with this release, mind you, with the Beta 1 release, but certainly a big goal for IE8. But also we're looking at a lot of JavaScript functionality that we didn't have before, making our JavaScript engine much more powerful than it was before, much faster.
Excellent.
And adding a bunch of tools for Web 2.0 authors, you know, giving them the ability to do cross-domain requests to do some really powerful mashups, cross-domain messaging to do sort of safer mashups, and also getting the ability to do local store access. So kind of like you were mentioning before, we used to have this user data capability in IE, and it was kind of hard to use, and it was pretty limited. It really doesn't scale to today's web that's much larger, and for that matter, today's user machines, which typically have, you know, a really big hard drive.
Sure.
And you don't mind using a little bit more than 128K per site or something like that.
Uh-huh.
So a lot more capability there. A bunch of better sort of interaction with the navigation history and stack. You know, one of the problems that I always have with the mapping services that are out there on the web is just the ability to forward a particular map to somebody and, you know, checkpoint it and just say, here you go. And there's always a button somewhere on there, but I always forget, and I just go to the address bar and I copy it and I try to paste it somewhere. Mm-hmm. And then you just see the entire U.S. map, which isn't really helpful.
Yeah.
So we've built some capabilities, again, you know, really borrowing on the HTML5 draft that's out there to do that, you know, to give people to give Web 2 authors the ability to use those capabilities and update the URL as they go. Hmm. And then finally, for users, there are two things that we added that I'm really, really excited about, just because they're an opportunity for web services out there. The first one is called Activities, and it you know, to borrow on the mapping example, it's really the ability to take a service like mapping that you want to apply to the entire web for a user. You want a user to be able to use that mapping capability when they're on a random restaurant website and they want to figure out, okay, they gave me an address, where is this? They don't need to link to a mapping site necessarily or choose a mapping site for you. You can just select that text, and then if you have the activity already installed, you right-click and say map with, you know, Live Maps, map with Yahoo Maps, Google Maps, whatever you want to install on your machine. And the descriptors for these, the ability to install one of those activities, is a very open specification. It's something that we've developed in concert with some other people. And we have the ability to deliver one of these for any service. You can do, you know, email via Google Mail or something like that. It's quite easy to write one of these, and there's a lot of a lot of them already written for services that are already out there. Very easy to write new ones if you want to translate with a different translator service or something like that. And then the second capability that we've added is called web slices. And web slices are the ability to on a web page that you might already visit, the web page author can actually mark up a section of their content with this derivative of the HAtom microformat and say, you know, this content is going to update, and I want to give users the ability to tuck that into their user experience, see it in their default UI. So if I want to have a constant update of what the current weather report is, or if I want to say, hey, this auction is really, really interesting to me, and I want to stick it into my toolbar for a while, because I want to watch it as the auction closes out or something like that. Or if I want to see how many new emails I have in my, you know, live mailbox, in my Hotmail mailbox, I can do that. I can have them mark up the page. I can mark up my services page. And then a user can say, oh, I want to add this to my toolbar for now. I want to make sure that I know when this auction is going to close out or anything like that. So really a lot of opportunities for services to interact more directly with their users and with users of other websites as well, not just, oh, I have to remember to go to the Live Maps site or something like that to use it.
Cool. So now, you know, a lot of developers would want to know, is that API not pluggable, but automatable? So in other words, could I come to a web page, say, click on this button, then I'll add my, you know, they're not activities, but the thing that I'm checking out.
The web slice.
The web slice, yep. Yeah, it's a really interesting name.
Yeah, I mean, getting one of those marked up on your page so that a user can easily see it and monitor it, that actually is certainly automatable. It's a pretty simple microformat, actually, HAtom is, and we've had to extend it a little bit because the big difference between this and what HAtom has been used for so far is really around the dynamic aspect of it. The fact that, you know, this isn't just a blog post. It's something that's going to be updated over time, and, you know, this is how often you might want to go look at it, or this is when it's going to essentially time out. Like, after an auction is completed, it's not all that interesting to keep updating it constantly, right? But until that auction completes, it's very interesting to update it because it can change pretty quickly.
So now let's talk a little bit about that updating process. You're making asynchronous requests out to something. You're polling.
Yeah, this is really very, very similar to how feeds work with RSS and Atom. In IE7, you know, it's a synchronization engine. It has to know how often it should ask for that feed and ask for that item specifically. Because you don't need to have a separate feed. It actually pulls it out of the HTML page. It looks for these class-based markup in the page and pulls it out directly and then uses that to stick the information up into your toolbar.
Excellent. So now you mentioned
your links bar, sorry.
You've extended stuff, and IE's done that a lot. Like, you've extended functionality to help. So how did that, you know, would people yell at you? I mean, you've been upfront about
you know,
about
that's
what you're doing?
That's an ongoing process, and certainly the actual syntax for how we do that, it's still not necessarily completely locked in. You know, we haven't shipped our final release yet. We sort of looked at what was out there, came up with the idea of what the problem that we thought was most important to solve, this sort of dynamic updating of items, and applied the capabilities, the specifications that are already out there. And we're certainly contributing everything that we're doing back into the Creative Commons public domain. But you know, I think that we're looking for a lot of input with this beta release on how that works and the syntax of it too. I mean, that's certainly not completely done, so I'm sure there'll be some changes before we finally ship, but based on community feedback.
Cool. Well, it's beta 1, right?
It is beta 1.
You'll get a lot
yes.
of feedback.
It is beta 1. We will hopefully get a lot of feedback.
Now, have you done work in actually the rendering performance?
You know, we've done a ton of work in, well, I actually see them kind of as separate between rendering and performance, because rendering typically is not where most of the performance problems are in a web browser. There's certainly the opportunity for rendering to take a really long time, but most of the time is in something you do in navigation, or it's you know, the JavaScript engine isn't as interactive as we would have liked it to be, or you know, my personal favorite is add-ons. A lot of times performance problems are because add-ons that are installed on the system aren't they're doing something they don't need to do, or they're doing something repetitively, and we've actually started helping some of the add-on authors look at their performance problems and look at where the time is going. But we have done a lot of work in performance, just in raw performance. I think in a lot of different scenarios, some of those are the sort of core navigation scenarios and layout and rendering and that sort of thing. One of the areas that I'm most interested to get feedback on in beta 1 is actually JavaScript performance. Done a lot of work around the object model, and the core JavaScript engine itself has been dramatically improved, and we've got a lot more work that we're planning to do after beta 1 as well.
Excellent.
But I think we've got some really impressive gains in performance over where we were with IE7 and IE6. Mm-hmm. So I'm really interested to see where that goes. The second thing, though, kind of unrelated to performance, but around rendering, is, you know, with IE8, we've spent a lot of time working up to beta 1 just because we've been building a brand new layout engine. And we started this whole effort to build a new layout engine with a copy of the CSS 2.1 spec in hand, you know, draft at the time, of course. And we've spent a tremendous amount of time just trying to adhere very, very carefully to both that specification and the goal of being interoperable with other browsers on just styling, layout, and object model. And that's been a really big undertaking for us. Again, you know, we're certainly not done with beta 1. We've got a little bit more work to do. But I've been really pleased with how far we've gotten, given that, you know, we essentially started over with layout. For the people out on the web who understand what this means, we don't have this concept of has layout anymore in the new engine. In the old engine, it's still there for compatibility. Some websites absolutely need to be running with that engine in order to get exactly the same behavior.
Okay.
But we did a ton of work just around getting a new layout engine in. This is the largest single item that we did in beta 1 was building this new layout engine and getting it in.
So, you know, architecturally, and I believe we touched on this in our last interview, but so it sounds to me like you have two engines.
Sort of.
Right?
You know, I use the word engine a little bit loosely. You know, we talked last time about since IE4, we've had this concept, this internal DLL, mshtml.dll, that was originally codenamed Trident. And we still have Trident, and we will have Trident for a very, very long time to come. Because Trident isn't just the rendering engine or the layout engine. It's actually sort of the end-to-end. At one point, it knows how to take in a bunch of just raw bytes and read that in, parse that as HTML, as CSS. And then it knows how to render that on the other end, and it knows how to interact with it. It knows how to offer programming APIs onto that and dynamically update the programming APIs. It knows how to edit and all these other things. And those things haven't dramatically changed. Certainly, some of the programming APIs we offer on that have changed, and the piece that we've really gone in and put a side-by-side replacement for is specifically the layout engine part. You know, the thing that actually takes the elements inside our internal tree and says, okay, I'm going to apply all the styling to it, and now let's start building all of the rendering objects, all of the text that I'm drawing, all the lines, all the backgrounds, the images, all that kind of stuff. So that part is kind of side-by-side inside the overall Trident engine. But Trident itself does tremendously more than just layout, right? It has to do all the object model parsing and rendering and all that sort of stuff, all the dynamic updating and that sort of thing.
Interesting. So it would be kind of fun just to talk briefly about the architecture of IE.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, where does the script engine live in this puzzle? Where does, I mean, let's just talk a little bit
it's
about
it. It is a very big and pretty complex diagram. Really, I personally always think of it, and there are many ways to diagram this, and I've been through a lot of them in the last decade or so. I always think of it as, well, you know, you take HTML in on one end, and you draw stuff on the screen on the other end, and in between you do a whole bunch of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at it that way, you know, you start with the parser that's built into Trident, and the even before you get into that, there's the whole wrapper for that, the document view interface and the iExplorer.exe host for all of Internet Explorer.
Mm.
And the thing that knows, oh, here's how to offer up a menu and here's how you get to your favorites and here's where the address bar lives and all that sort of thing. But if you just look at the Trident part of it, the sort of HTML, CSS dynamic engine, you start with parsing, you build this object tree, this element tree in the middle, and then you apply a bunch of styles to that based on the attributes and the style sheets that are in the document. And then you run that on sort of a need-to-know basis, you run that through the layout engine. So the layout engine says, oh, I need to draw something, what's the first thing I need to draw? And it starts pulling from the element tree and figuring out what it needs to render, and starts measuring and laying out all those objects. And it does that by creating a display tree of some form, right? Internally, just where I'm going to draw objects, what those objects are, text, lines, images, even solid color fills, that sort of thing.
Mm.
And then that gets drawn on the screen on a usual sort of Windows application system, WM paint sort of way, just gets updated onto the screen. But of course, there are a bunch of pieces that I didn't really cover there, and the JavaScript engine is a big one.
Sure.
The JavaScript engine kind of gloms onto the side of the element tree in a way, right? Because the element tree has a bunch of APIs that it offers, the document object model from the W3C, as well as, you know, some IE specific APIs. And the JavaScript engine is hosted by Trident in the sense of we fire up the JScript DLL and we own making sure that it's doing the right thing and that sort of thing. And we've been spending a lot of time optimizing that particular relationship with the JScript DLL in IE8 as well.
Cool.
It's been really one of the big things that we realized in IE7 and really couldn't attack in the IE7 product cycle was the idea that, you know, between 1998-99, when we were doing all of the product planning for IE6, and 2004, when we started building IE7, the patterns of what people ran into on the web changed, right? Mm. It wasn't static web pages anymore, or even richly styled static web pages with a little bit of interactivity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, one of the sites that I use the most on the web is Flickr. And Flickr, when you start organizing photos, it's a pretty dynamic experience. Right, and I want drag and drop to be really fast. I want it to work just like it does on a desktop application. That quick, that good sort of user feedback. And I think that we realized that and we started realizing that we needed to revamp the programmability engine and the connection with the JavaScript engine. And we've got a great team that's been working on the JavaScript engine itself, doing a ton of work there. And we've been working very, very closely with them. Like, some of their guys sit in our building right next to our team.
Nice.
To make sure that we're getting the interactivity down and really doing well there.
Cool. I mean, I remember one of the things, Eric Lippert used to always, on the JScript alias, would always, when people were using eval, would kind of freak out.
Yeah.
Man, that generates a new instance of the JScript engine.
It does.
Are you crazy? So has there been any work to solve that? It's not really solving a problem, but
yeah,
to make it less,
you know, the way that eval actually works, it does basically need to fork off another instance. We've looked at it a little bit. I think that most of the time what we're really trying to do is make it so that people don't need to do that sort of shotgun approach to solving their problems, and solving problems in a little bit tighter way than that.
Excellent. So you've added some new objects, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, more programmability.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, you know, one of the big things with several of the features that we're doing, really from a high level, you know, we just looked at it as how do Web 2.0 apps get built? What do they need to do? What's the pattern that people or patterns that people are really interested in? Mm-hmm. And obviously a really big one was just the mashup pattern, right? The idea of, you know, I don't own all the interesting data in the world on my website. My data comes from a bunch of different places. I want to communicate with that. And that sort of spawned a whole set of functionality that we wanted to make sure that we got in. And most of this, you know, we're the W3C was really looking at that anyways with HTML5 and in the HTML5 working group, which I co-chair, so, you know, obviously I've got a little clue of what's going on there. But there were a bunch of different objects that were really interesting that the people that we talked to, the web developers that we talked to, mm-hmm. were like, these are the things, the problems we really need to solve, right? We need some local storage so that we have some way of caching data on the client and a reasonable amount of data.
Like, absolutely.
Not, you know, not super limited, not, you know, cookie size sort of things, but that level of storage on the client that I can very, very quickly get to, that's not a network transaction every time I want to see if you've got this image cached or something like that. And then the second problem was really around, well, I want to do a cross-domain transaction. I want to get data from some other source. Mm-hmm. And the hard part here, of course, you know, we have this XML request, XML HTTP request object that we've had for a very long time, mm-hmm. and it doesn't allow you to do cross-domain transactions. And there's a reason for that, of course. Like, you don't want site A to be able to get to all of the data that your user can get to on site B. Like, that could be a dangerous thing if site B happens to be Bank of America or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And so we managed to lock down what XML HTTP request gets to, mm-hmm. but then it turns out that's a really interesting thing to do, right? Is get data from a different site.
Certainly.
So people have been figuring out ways around that. Obviously, you can include JavaScript from a different site directly. You can, you know, host images or whatever from different sites. There are a bunch of tricks you can do with hosting iframes inside a page as well, which again, it's kind of a challenging build a better mousetrap kind of approach to figuring out how to get around the limitations that were put in for good reason.
Sure.
And it ends up having to do a lot of work that you really shouldn't need to do. Like if site A and site B both agree, hey, this transaction is okay, it's okay to share this data across these two domains, mm-hmm. you should be able to do that. And it should be easy, it should be really just like XML HTTP request, but enabled cross-domain. And that's really what we tried to do in that arena. Hmm. And then there was the idea of, well, sometimes I kind of want different domains to be running, but I want to be able to communicate between them really easily. I want to be able to send messages back and forth. This was one of the things that we found with things like hosting ads, where you really don't want a third-party ad to be hosted in your website's domain context, right? You want it to be sort of held at arm's length, but at the same time, you want to be able to say, hey, I'm changing pages now, or I want to resize the page. You should figure out something to do to reduce yourself in size, or some other trick that an ad might want to respond to, some other event that an ad might want to respond to.
Interesting.
So we added cross-domain messaging to the list of things we wanted to do.
So, I mean, that's important because you've really narrowed down the scope of how two objects running different domains can communicate.
Exactly.
I mean, that's important.
One of the most important things for security, for enabling users to be confident about the security of the system, is really to pick the specific scenarios you're trying to enable, mm-hmm. and then enable those scenarios, and don't just enable a bunch of stuff to the sides of it accidentally, because that's where security problems creep in, right? That's where exploits are found, when you enable a bunch of things that weren't really intended, and people find exploits that way.
Absolutely. And when you're using, you know, an internet-facing application, where the internet really is full of sharks.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a challenging. We haven't really talked about it very much yet, but clearly you guys are consistently and have done work in officially named IE8.
You know, absolutely.
We haven't said that yet.
Well, we've said IE8. Last year we were saying, you know, there is a next version of IE, and it is called IE8.
Cool.
I think Bill Gates actually said that first. So.
All right, IE8. So security. Right on.
Yeah,
I mean,
security.
You're adding new features. You're adding new functionality.
Yep.
That always is a security burden.
There is.
What have you
always,
guys done?
Always a challenge there. You know, we've been doing a bunch of different work, and not all of it is completely ready yet. But certainly, the biggest thing for us is just any new functionality that we do, we have to go through full, you know, thorough security reviews of the scenarios that we're intending to enable and how the feature is actually built, so that we know we're not enabling stuff off to the sides, right? We're not enabling more than we intended to. There are a bunch of things that we're doing to sort of narrow down the scope of what's available now as well. And there are a bunch of things in the product that are really targeted to securely enabling new scenarios too. Like in Windows XP Service Pack 2, you know, there was a bunch of updates to IE in that, and unfortunately it never really got a product name, so it's kind of IE6 XPSP2, and it didn't deliver to anyone who wasn't using XP Service Pack 2. It was only there. And then with IE7, we took all of those capabilities and put them into the core product.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did a whole bunch more with IE7 too, right? We did anti-phishing, and we did anti-malware on Windows Vista with protected mode, and a bunch of other capabilities that were very, very security focused. I mean, our biggest investment in IE7 was around increasing the security of the overall system, both having user-facing features like anti-phishing, doing sort of core security features in the system, like making the add-on manager better and delivering that to everybody and that sort of thing, but also providing sort of these last line of defense capabilities like the like protected mode, you know, that's really intended to, well, you might find an exploit, but let's limit the damage that you can actually do. With IE8, you know, we've been extending some of those capabilities. Mm-hmm. We've also been looking more at just making sure that we are building security into everything we do, and then adding some user-facing security things like the domain gets highlighted, right? So you can clearly see, wait a second, that email message said it was supposed to be, you know, Bank of America needed me to update my security information, but, you know, wait a second, this isn't Bank of America, this is some weird site in you know, some random country or something. And I'm not picking on Bank of America, by the way. I'm a B of A customer, so that's why I choose them. So, you know, when I look at the investments that we've done in security, I think that we've done less of a user-facing investment in security in IE8, less obvious investment, I should say, but we spent a lot more time getting security right across the board and building that work into the reliability of the overall system.
Outstanding. I mean, because, you know, security should be a lot like the kernel of an operating system. You shouldn't know it's there.
Absolutely.
So it's good that you're not creating a bunch of new prompts for people to have to click through.
Well, and absolutely. That is definitely a goal. We found that's not the greatest way to go about making a secure system, just asking lots of questions.
Yes.
I mean, I'm guilty of hitting OK just to see a site, too. So, and I think one of the other things, too, is security is really, much like performance, it's one of those things where you can't just, you know, add it on at the end. Like, you have to spend a lot of time up front understanding your own features and understanding all of the code that you have and what it's intended to do, and making sure that it's only doing what it's intended to do.
Absolutely. Now, have you made any changes to adding more codability to CSS? I mean, I remember with CSS, you could actually write lines of code that got evaluated as expressions.
Yeah.
Has there been any work there to?
You know, we haven't taken that up any further, mostly because we'd like to see that go into some version of that. Go into the CSS standard. Most of the work that we've been doing in CSS is around, you know, rebuilding the layout engine, getting it so that it does all of these the CSS that we used to handle according to the specification, and then adding a bunch of CSS2 and capabilities, primarily because, you know, we wanted to pass the ACID2 test, and there were a bunch of capabilities that the ACID2 test explicitly tested. We didn't do generated content, counters, you know, display table types, that sort of thing. Being able to sort of dynamically create tables declaratively from a style sheet, just when you have some content, and say, hey, I know this looks like a list now. I want to format it like a table.
Wow.
You can now do that completely within a style sheet without using a HTML tables at all.
Now, do people actually hand write these things, or are there tools?
A little of both, really. Yeah. You know, there are certainly some people who hand write these things. Mm-hmm. The tools that are out there, you know, when I think of tools, it's sort of a broad spectrum. It's not just, you know, me using Dreamweaver or some tool like that, or mm-hmm. or Expression Web or something. It's really, there are a bunch of frameworks out there. There are styling frameworks, there are interactivity frameworks, there are script frameworks, all of these things. You know, there are some super, super smart people out there who write these frameworks, who build these frameworks. And they're the ones, I think, who typically adopt a lot of this functionality first. And then a lot of people get the benefit of that because they're using frameworks.
Cool.
Because they've leveraged somebody who knows how to say, okay, just write your content and then apply the framework to it in this way.
Excellent. So, Beta 1.
Beta 1, big milestone, yeah. Very big milestone
awesome.
For us. We're really excited to get the work out there, to start talking about all the work that we've been doing, the priorities we've had, so mm-hmm. it's great.
You guys have been burning the midnight oil for a
while. We have been burning the midnight oil. It's been a really busy time for quite a while, yeah.
Very cool. So I guess one question I would ask is add-ons you mentioned. Uh-huh. Has there been any work on maybe on protecting add-ons from hurting the experience? Because you can write unmanaged add-ons,
yeah.
right?
You can write unmanaged add-ons. In fact, most add-ons that are available are unmanaged. Mm. And you know, there has been a bunch of work in various areas to make that experience better. Certainly, IE7 did a ton of work around making the add-on experience better. Protected mode did
sure.
a tremendous amount to improve this, actually. So under Windows Vista, you actually get a much better add-on experience, or at least, I should say, a more targeted add-on experience. Mm. One of the problems in the past that we've seen is add-ons run in the IE process, so they have really tight access to all of the content on the page and that sort of thing. The downside to this, of course, is if an add-on crashes, it typically crashes IE too. Mm. And we've started building some robustness capabilities into IE to be a bit more resilient to those crashes, but with Windows Vista, you actually get better error reporting also. Mm. So with IE, you will see, oh, we may have crashed, but we crashed because of this particular add-on you were running. And we have the ability to say, are you sure you want to keep running that add-on because it caused problems and offering updates and that sort of thing.
Very cool.
So, and of course, one of the other things that we did with IE8 too is we wrapped all of the add-ons together and made a better user experience around the add-on manager. So you can see all of your toolbars and your ActiveX control add-ons and, you know, even your search providers and that sort of thing. So you can manage all of them in one place, and you can say, oh, I didn't even realize I was still running that toolbar or anything like that,
cool.
and enable them, disable them, that sort of thing.
All right. So when developers get their hands on IE8 Beta 1, let's get some feedback.
Absolutely.
And you
yes.
guys will
Give
listen, of course.
Give us feedback, yeah. Watch the IE blog. We'll talk about the feedback system and that sort of thing.
Outstanding. Well, hey, it's always great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you, too.
And
thanks for having me again.
Sure. And maybe we'll talk about Beta 2 when it comes out.
I'm sure
pictures
I'm sure
of
we
it.
Are, yeah.
All right. Well, great to talk to you, Chris.
Thanks, Ross.
Thanks.